She was alive. For however much longer, this was a brutal, beautiful, and brand new fact for Juliet. She had spent 3 days climbing long stairs similar to these as she came to grips with her fate. Another day and night had been spent in a cell made for the future corpses who dotted the landscape. And then, this. An impossible trek through the wilderness of the forbidden, breaking in to the impenetrable and the unknown, surviving. Whatever happened next, for this moment, Juliet flew down foreign steps in bare feet, the steel cool against her tingling skin, the air burning her throat less and less with each gulp of new air, the raw stench and memory of death receding further and further above her. Soon, it was just the patter of her joyous descent ringing out and drifting down a lonely and empty darkness, like a muffled bell that rang not for the dead, but for the living. She stopped on 6 and rested while she worked on what remained of her protective suit. With care, she sliced her black undersuit by her shoulders and collarbone, working the tear all the way around and clawing at her back as it ripped free, strips of heat tape still attached. Once the helmet collar was detached from the fabric, just the zipper, hanging like a second spine along her back, she could finally remove it from her neck. She pulled it off and dropped it to the ground, then stripped off the rest of the black carbon fabric, peeling away the arms and legs and leaving all the material in a rough pile outside the double doors to level 6. 6 should be an apartment level, she thought. She considered going inside and yelling out for help or looking for clothes and supplies in the many rooms, but her greater impulse was to descend. The uptop felt poisoned and too close. It didn't matter if it was all in her imagination or if it was from her miserable experiences living in the uptop of her own silo. Her body felt a revulsion for the place. Safe was the down deep. It had always felt this way. One hopeful image did linger from the upper kitchen. The rows and rows of canned and jarred food for the lean harvests. Juliet figured there would be more in the lower mess halls as well. And the air in the silo seemed decent as she regained her breath. The sting in her lungs and on her tongue had faded. Either the vast silo held a lot of air that was now being consumed by no one, or there was still a source. All these thoughts gave her hope, these tallies of resources. So she left her spoiled and tattered clothing behind, and armed with only a large chef's knife, she stole down the curved stairs naked, her body becoming more and more alive with every step taken, her mind becoming more determined to keep the rest of her that way. On 13, she stopped and checked inside the doors. There was always the chance that this silo was laid out completely differently, floor to floor, so it made little sense to plan ahead if she didn't know what to expect. There were only a handful of areas in the uptop that she was intimately familiar with, and every bit of overlap so far had seemed a perfect copy. 13, she would definitely know. There were certain things, learned so young and remembered so deep, that they felt like little stones in the center of her mind. These would be the parts of her that rotted last, the bits left over once the rest skittered off on the wind or was drunk deep by the roots. In her mind, as she pushed the door open a crack, she wasn't in a different silo, an abandoned husk of a silo, but in her past, pushing open a door on her youth. It was dark inside, none of the security or emergency lights on. There was a different smell. The air was stagnant and had a tinge of decay. Juliet shouted down the hallway, "Hello?" She listened to her voice echo back from the empty walls. The voice that returned sounded distant, weaker, higher than her own. She imagined herself at age 9, running through these very halls, crying out to her older self across the years. She tried to picture her mother chasing behind that girl, attempting to scoop her up and force her to be still. But the ghosts evaporated in the darkness. The last of the echoes faded, leaving her alone and naked in the doorway. As her eyes adjusted, she could just barely make out a reception desk at the end of the hall. Light reflected off glass windows just where they should be. It was the exact same layout as her father's nursery in the Mids, the place where she had been not just born, but raised. It was hard to believe that this was someplace different, that other people had lived here, other children had been born, had played, and had been raised just over a hill and down a dip, had given chase or challenged each other to hop or whatever games they had invented, all of them unaware of the other. Maybe it was from standing in the doorway of a nursery, but she couldn't help but think of all the lives this place had contained. People growing up, falling in love, burying their dead. All those people outside. People she had desecrated with her boots, scattering their bones and ashes as she kicked her way into the very place they had fled. Juliet wondered how long ago it had happened, how long since the silo had been abandoned. What had happened here? The stairwell was still lit, which meant the battery room still held juice. She needed paper to do the math, to figure how recently or how long ago all this life had turned to death. There were practical reasons for wanting to know, beyond the mere itch of curiosity. With one last look inside, one final shudder of regret for not stopping to see her father the last few times she'd passed his nursery, Juliet shut the door on the darkness and the ghosts and considered her predicament. She could very well be perfectly alone in a dying silo. The thrill of being alive at all was quickly draining away, replaced with the reality of her solitude and the tenuousness of her survival. Her stomach grumbled its agreement. She could somehow still smell the fetid soup on her, could taste the stomach acid from her retching. She needed water. She needed clothes. These primal urges were pushed to the forefront, drowning out the severity of her situation, the daunting tasks before her, leaving the regrets of the past behind. If the layout was the same, the first hydroponic farm would be 4 floors down. The larger of the 2 upper dirt farms would lie just below that. Juliet shivered from an updraft of cold air. The stairwell was creating its own thermal cycle, and it would only be colder the further down she went. But she went anyway. Lower was better. At the next level, she tried the door. It was too dark to see past the first interior hallway, but it seemed like offices or workrooms. She tried to remember what would be on the 14th in her own silo, but didn't know. Was it incredible to not know? The uptop of her own home had somehow been strange to her. That made this silo something completely alien. She held the door to 14 open and stuck the blade of her knife between the slits of metal that formed every landing's grating. The handle was left sticking up to form a stop. She allowed the door to close on its sprung hinges until it rested on the handle, holding it open. This let in enough light for her to steal inside and grope around the first handful of rooms. There were no coveralls hanging on the backs of the doors, but one room was set up for conferences. The water in the pitchers had long evaporated out, but the purple tablecloth looked warm enough. Warmer than being naked. Juliet moved the assortment of cups, plates, and pitchers and grabbed the cloth. She wrapped it around her shoulders, but it was going to slip off when she moved, so she tried knotting the corners in front of her. Giving up on this, she ran back to the landing, out into the welcomed light, and removed the fabric completely. Grabbing the knife, the door squealing eerily shut behind her, she pushed the blade through the center of the tablecloth and cut a long gash. Her head went through this, the cloth falling past her feet in front and behind her. A few minutes with the blade and she'd cut away the excess, forming a belt out of a long strip and, from another shock of fabric, enough to tie over her head and keep it warm. It felt good to be making something, to be engineering her way through one particular problem. She had a tool, a weapon, if need be, and clothes. The impossible list of tasks had been whittled down a few shavings. She descended further, her feet cold on the stairs, dreaming of boots, thirsty for water, very much aware of all that remained for her to do. On 15, she was reminded of another necessity as her weary legs nearly gave way. Her knees buckled. She grabbed the railing and she realized, as the adrenaline evaporated from her veins, that she was deathly tired. She paused on the landing, hands on her knees, and took a few deep breaths. How long had she been going? How much further could she push herself? She checked her reflection in the blade of the knife, saw how horrible she looked, and decided she needed rest before she went any further. Rest now, while it was still warm enough to not shiver to pieces. It was tempting to explore that level for a bed, but she decided against it. There would be little comfort in the pitch black behind those doors. So she curled up on the steel grating of Landing 15, tucked her arms under her head, and adjusted the tablecloth so every patch of bare skin was covered. And before she could go over the long list forming in her head, exhaustion took over. She drifted off to sleep with only a moment's panic that she shouldn't be so tired, that this might be the sort of nap one never woke up from, that she was destined to join the residents of this strange place, curled up and unmoving, frozen and lifeless, rotting and wasting away. 12. But old folks, many feign as they were dead, unwieldy, slow, heavy, and pale as lead.
Do you understand what you're proposing we do?
Knox looked up at McLean, met her wrinkled and wizened eyes with as much confidence as he could muster. The tiny woman who controlled all the silo's spares and fabrication cast an oddly imposing figure. She didn't have Knox's barrel chest or thick beard, had wrists barely bigger than two of his fingers, but she possessed a wizened gray gaze and the weight of hard years that made him feel but a shadow in her presence.
"It's not an uprising," he said,
the forbidden words moving easily with the grease of habit and time.
"We're setting things to right."
McLean sniffed.
"I'm sure that's what my great-grandparents said."
She pushed back loose strands of silver hair and peered down at the blueprint spread out between them. It was as if she knew this was wrong, but had resigned herself to helping rather than hinder it. Maybe it was her age, Knox thought, peering at her pink scalp through hair so thin and white as to be like filaments of glass. Perhaps, with enough time in these walls, one could become resigned to things never getting better, or even changing all that much. Or maybe a person eventually lost hope that there was anything worth preserving at all. He looked down at the blueprint and smoothed the sharp creases in the fine paper. He was suddenly aware of his hands, how thick and grease-limbed his fingers appeared. He wondered if McLean saw him as a brute, storming up here with delusions of justice. She was old enough to see him as young, he realized, young and hot-tempered, while he thought of himself as being old and wise. One of the dozens of dogs that lived among supplies stacks grunted discontentedly under the table as if all this war planning were spoiling its nap.
"I think it's safe to assume IT knows something is coming," McLean said, running her small hands across the many floors between them and 34.
"Why? You don't think we were discreet coming up?"
She smiled up at him.
"I'm sure you were, but it's safe to assume this because it would be dangerous to assume otherwise."
He nodded and chewed on the part of his beard below his lower lip.
"How long will the rest of your mechanics take to get here?"
McLean asked.
"They'll leave around 10 when the stairwell is dimmed and be here by 2, 3 at the latest. They'll be loaded down."
And you think a dozen of your men is sufficient to keep things running down below?
As long as nothing major breaks, yeah.
He scratched the back of his neck.
Where do you think the porters will fall? Or the people from the mids?
She shrugged. The mids see themselves as toppers, mostly. I know, I spent my childhood up there. They go for the view and eat at the cafe as much as they can, justifying the climb. The toppers are another question. I think we have more hope among them. Knox wasn't sure he heard her correctly.
Say again?
She looked up at him, and Knox felt the dog nuzzling against his boots, looking for company or warmth.
Well, think about it, McLean said. Why are you so riled up? Because you lost a good friend? That happens all the time. No, it's because you were lied to. And the toppers will feel this ever more keenly, trust me. They live in sight of those who've been lied to. It's the mids, the people who aspire upward without knowing and who look down on us without compassion, that will be the most reluctant.
So you think we have allies up top?
That we can't get to, yeah. And they would take some convincing. A fine speech like you poisoned my people with.
She gifted him with a rare grin, and Knox felt himself beaming in return. And right then he knew, instantly, why her people were devoted to her. It was similar to the pull he had on others, but for different reasons. People feared him and wanted to feel safe, but they respected McLean and wanted to feel loved.
The problem we're going to have is that the mids are what separates us from IT.
She drew her hand across the blueprint.
So we need to get through there quick, but without starting a fight.
I thought we'd just storm up before dawn,
Knox grumbled. He leaned back and peered under the table at the dog, who was half sitting on one of his boots and looking up at him with its foolish tongue hanging out, tail wagging. All Knox saw in the animal was a machine that ate food and left shit behind. A furry ball of meat he wasn't allowed to eat. He nudged the filthy thing off his boot.
Scram,
he said.
Jackson, get over here.
McLean snapped her fingers.
I don't know why you keep those things around, much less breed more of them.
You wouldn't, McLean snapped back. They're good for the soul, for those of us who have them.
He checked to see if she was serious and found her smiling a little more easily now.
Well, after we set this place right, I'm going to push for a lottery for them, too. Get their numbers under control.
He returned her sarcastic smile. Jackson whined until McLean reached down to pet him.
If we were all as loyal as this to each other, there'd never need to be an uprising, she said, peering up at him.
He dipped his head, unable to agree. There had been a few dogs in Mechanical over the years, enough for him to know that some people felt this way, even if he didn't. He always shook his head at those who spent hard-earned chits on food that would fatten a thing that would never fatten him in return. When Jackson crossed under the table and rubbed against his knee, whining to be petted, he left his hands spread out on the blueprint, defiant.
"What we need for the trip up is a diversion," McLean said. "Something to thin the numbers in the mids. It'd be nice if we could get more of them to go up top, because we're going to make a racket moving this many people up the stairs."
"We? Wait, you don't think you're coming?"
"If my people are, then of course I am." She inclined her head. "I've been climbing ladders in the stockroom for over 50 years. You think a few flights of stairs will give me grief?"
Knox wasn't sure anything could give her grief. Jackson's tail thumped the leg of the table as the mutt stood there, looking up at him with that dumb grin his breed habitually wore.
"What about welding doors shut on the way up?" Knox asked. "Keep 'em in until all this is over."
"And do what afterwards? Just apologize? What if this takes weeks?"
"Weeks?
You don't think it'll be that easy, do you? Just march up and take the reins?"
"I'm under no delusions about what comes next."
He pointed at her office door, which led out to the workshops full of clacking machinery.
"Our people are building the implements of war, and I aim to use them if it comes to that. I will gladly take a peaceful transfer, would be satisfied pushing Bernard and a few others out to clean, but I have never shied from getting dirty, either."
McLean nodded.
Just so we're both clear.
Clear as glass, he said.
He clapped his hands, an idea forming. Jackson ducked away from the sudden noise.
I've got it, he told her. A diversion.
He pointed to the lower floors of mechanical on the blueprint.
What if we have Jenkins cascade a power outage? We could start a few levels above this, or even better, with the farms and the mess halls. Blame it on the recent generator work.
And do you think the mids will clear out?
She narrowed her eyes.
If they want a warm meal, or they'll hunker down in the dark.
I think they'll be in the stairwell gossiping, wondering what all the fuss is about, even more in our way.
Then we'll tell them we're going up to fix the problem.
Knox felt himself getting frustrated. The damn dog was sitting on his boot again.
Up to fix a problem? McLean laughed. When's the last time that made any sense?
Knox pulled on his beard. He wasn't sure what was so complicated. There were a lot of them. They worked with tools all day. They were going to go beat in tech heads, little men like Bernard who sat on their butts and clacked on keyboards like secretaries. They just needed to go up there and do it.
You got any better ideas?
He asked.
We need to keep in mind the after, McLean said. After you've bludgeoned some people to death and the blood is dripping through the grates, what then? Do you want people living in fear of that happening again, or of whatever you put them through to get there?
I only want to hurt those that lied, he said. That's all any of us want. We've all lived in fear. Fear of the outside, fear of cleaning, afraid to even talk about a better world, and none of it was true. The system was rigged, and in a way to make us hang our heads and take it.
Jackson barked up at him and began to whine, his tail swishing the floor like a dropped air hose with a stuck nozzle that had gone out of control.
I think when we're done, he said, and we start talking about using our know-how to explore a world we've only ever looked out at, I think that's going to inspire some people. Hell, it gives me hope. Don't you feel anything?
He reached down and rubbed Jackson's head, which stopped the animal from making so much noise. McLean looked at him for a while. She finally bobbed her head in agreement.
We'll go with the power outage, she said with finality. Tonight, before any who went to see the cleaning return disappointed. I'll lead up a squad with candles and flashlights, make it look like a goodwill mission headed by supply. You'll follow a few hours later with the rest. We'll see how far the repair story gets us before we run into trouble. Hopefully, a good number will be staying in the uptop, or back in their beds in the mids, too exhausted from climbing for a meal to care about the commotion.
There'll be less traffic those early hours, Knox agreed, so maybe we won't run into too much trouble.
The goal will be to hit IT and contain it. Bernard is still playing mayor, so he probably won't be there. But he'll either come to us or we'll push up after him once the 30s are secure. I don't think he'll put up much of a fight, not once his floors are ours.
Agreed,
Knox said, and it felt good to have a plan, to have an ally.
And hey, thanks for this.
McLean smiled.
You give a good speech for a greaser, she said. And besides,
she nodded toward the dog,
Jackson likes you, and he's hardly ever wrong. Not about men.
Knox looked down and realized he was still scratching the mutt. He pulled his hand away and watched the animal pant, staring up at him. In the next room, someone laughed at a joke, the voices of his mechanics mixing with the members of supply, all gently muffled by the wall and door. This laughter was joined by the sounds of steel rods bending into shape, flat pieces hammered sharp, machines for making rivets turned instead into making bullets. And Knox knew what McLean meant about loyalty. He saw it in that dumb dog's eyes, that it would do anything for him if only he would ask. And this weight bearing down on his chest, of the many who felt that way for him and for McLean, Knox decided that this was the heaviest burden of them all. 13. Death's pale flag is not advanced there.
The dirt farm below filled the stairwell with a rich smell of fresh rot. Juliet was still waking up as she descended another level and began noticing the scent. She had no idea how long she'd slept. It had felt like days, but could have been hours. She had woken with her face pressed to the grating, a pattern of red lines marking her cheek, and had gotten underway immediately. Her stomach was gnawing at her, the odor from the farm hurrying her along. By 28, the pungency hung in the air so thick it felt like she was swimming through the scents. It was the smell of death, she decided, of funerals, of loamy soil turned over, releasing all those tangy molecules into the air. She stopped on 30, the hydroponic farms, and tried the doors. It was dark inside. There was a sound down the hallway, the whir of a fan or a motor. It was a strange encounter, this small noise. For over a day, she had heard nothing but the sounds she made herself. The green glow of the emergency lights were no company. They were like the heat of a dying body, of batteries draining with the leak of photons. But this was something moving, some sound beyond her own breathing and footfalls, and it lurked deep in the dark corridors of the hydroponic farms. Once again, she left her only tool and defense behind as a doorstop to allow in a trickle of light. She stole inside, the smell of vegetation not as strong as in the stairwell, and padded down the hallway with one hand on the wall. The offices and reception area were dark and lifeless, the air dry. There was no blinking light on the turnstile, and she had no card or chit to feed it. She placed her hands on the supports and vaulted over, this small act of defiance somehow powerful, as though she had come to accept the lawlessness of this dead place, the complete lack of civilization, of rules. The light spilling from the stairwell barely reached the first of the growing rooms. She waited while her eyes adjusted, thankful for this ability honed by the down deeps of mechanical and the dark interiors of broken machines. What she saw, barely, when she was finally able, did not inspire her. The hydroponic gardens had rotted away. Thick stalks, like ropes, hung here and there from a network of suspended pipes. It gave her an idea of how long ago these farms had succumbed, if not the silo. It hadn't been hundreds of years, and it hadn't been days. Even a window that wide felt like a treasure of information, the first crumb toward an answer to this mysterious place. She rapped one of the pipes with her knuckles and heard the solid thud of fullness. No plants, but water. Her mouth seemed to dry out with just the prospect. Juliet leaned over the railing and into the growing room. She pressed her mouth to one of the holes in the top of a pipe where the stalk of a plant should be growing. She created a tight seal and sucked. The fluid that met her tongue was brackish and foul, but wet. And the taste was not of anything chemical or toxic, but stale organics. Dirt. It was only slightly more distasteful than the grease and oil she had practically been drenched in for 2 decades. So she drank until she was full. And she realized, now that she had water, that if there were more crumbs to find, more clues, she might just live long enough to gather them. Before she left, Juliet snapped a section of pipe off at the end of a run, keeping the cap intact on one side.